I might be awake then. It's just.
You mentioned before of like, we just like with the when you were talking about National Coming Out Day of like, you know, this is how it started. It was just a bunch of people in the bar like watching the Olympics. Like, and I think for me as a younger queer person, that has been the fascinating thing going back through the history of like, my goodness, this was very DIY all the time. And I think we've forgotten how DIY it is. And I think we've forgotten that there is a lot of benefit that comes from finding community, of walking into like that P-Town or that Amherst Mass, and like just being surrounded by a bunch of other queer people, and that synergy that happens in those spaces, especially. And I think we've lost that because we no longer have the push factors that we used to in society. So depending on where you are and who you are, like I can walk down safely, I can walk down Congress Street safely holding my wife's hand and not assume or be or have my, as one oral history said, have my head on swivel all the time. So I can do that now. And so you forget that you also need to be looking for your people to have those conversations. So we're not being pushed into queer spaces from the outside world. We're kind of, if we're here in Portland at least, because it's not true everywhere, we can at least have, we're in just the general space. And I think it's still beneficial to have those queer spaces. I think some of us have just forgotten or not realized the benefit of it. And I think now with a lot of all these, with the anti-trans legislation, with generally that rearing of the ugly head, which all of this stuff that's happening now in the legislatures across the U.S. reminds me a lot of the Anita Bryan Save Your Children stuff. Yeah. It's almost like par for course. They've just changed of like, it's the gay men to like, it's the trans people now. So it's interesting. I think people are remembering of like, oh yeah, actually that those kind of spaces might actually be a good thing to have in community conversations and figure out how to do stuff.
Well, Megan mentioned the transgender attacks on transgender folks and legislation. Could you speak to that briefly? What's happening in Maine?
Yeah, there's been quite a number of things introduced. One of them, some of them are not directly, you know, they don't say that's what's going on, but it's what's going on. It's voiced sometimes in terms of, you know, parents' rights to control what their children can read in the schools. And I mean, we had a reading from Gender Queer on the floor of the legislature this week, and it was not a celebratory, sympathetic reading. It was a little painful. And I've read the book, you know, and I don't, you know, would it be my bedtime reading? No, but it can be, you know, but it's perfectly possible that it's very useful depending upon what your stage of life is in the conversation it can generate between you and the people around you who are older and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so it was quite a fight on the floor of the legislature, which I believe I don't know that it's entirely won, but we defeated the initiative in the House. So there's the whole book banning thing going on and curriculum fights about whether or not it's sort of like our version of the don't say gay stuff that's going on in Florida. It's not quite as volatile at all, but it's the same articulation. It's just it doesn't have the same pull-in of people, at least in the legislature. And I think it's because there are some very articulate folks in the legislature who are queer, like me and like Craig Hickman from up near the Capitol. He's a very articulate African-American man who has been there for a long time and speaks out well. Lori Osha, who represents Orono now, has begun to be very articulate. So there's a lot of voices there. And the other piece of what's going on with the trans stuff is the whole arguments about gender-affirming health care and whether it's going to be paid for under Maine Care if you happen to be a poor person. And so it feels to me like all of the fights we used to have about whether or not Maine Care or Medicare was going to pay for abortions is the same kind of headset, although obviously they're not the same topic. But when we were debating yesterday or the day before, my brain mushes together when I am in there 14 hours a day, whether or not it, you know, didn't pass. But there was an attempt to keep it from being funded by MaineCare. But there's also a lot of, I serve on the Judiciary Committee, and so we get a lot of those bills, and so there's, you have to listen to a lot of crap to make it through the day. And but it's particularly onerous when it's when not only do you feel your community attacked, and you feel like, you know, what am I going to do? What's my best, you know, what can I do to the best to make this go away? But you also, it's hard not to feel personally attacked, even if you've had no part in whatever the thing that they're screaming about is. But it's just hard. And there's, somebody's quite creative about the places where they're trying to hit the trans community particularly. And
there have been public hearings with the community showing up, right?
Yes, yeah. But that's very difficult for a community that is still quite vulnerable in the outside venue. I mean, there are some very articulate and brave people doing it. I mean, Quinn Gormley has been articulate.
I've heard lots about what Quinn is, you know. Done.
Yeah, and, you know, he's now, I mean, he's very brave about that kind of stuff.
She is.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for doing that, Lois. Like, I know it is a burden to do that. It's hard. It's not a burden, but it's like, it's
a
charge.
Yeah.
It's charred.
It's a challenge, yeah.
Yeah.
And, but I've been doing these fights for quite a long time. I just didn't have any power before. That's, you know, it is, for me, it's easier to do it when you have power, you know, even if you don't exercise it, just knowing you can do something, at least to bollocks up whatever's going on. If you can't, you know, entirely change it, you can screw it up enough to not have it pass.
Just to mention that Lois has rainbow fingernail polish on today. This is radio and not TV.
Actually, the irony is that usually I have on Pride Month, I have, I've solved the challenge of how you put six colors on five nails. I just want to know if anybody has any questions. But actually, the truth be told, these are not my Pride nails this year. These are the colors of lilacs in my yard.
Oh, no.
But usually I have Pride nails on this month, but I've been too busy to get my nails done because I can't get home from Augusta.
So how do you get the six colors? Are you just blending them?
No, you've cut this one in half. You know, you've,
right.
No, I didn't add a finger. I thought about it, but the cost seemed overwhelming.
The things we do.
I know, for fun, yeah.
Oh, I guess we have a call in. I was just going to repeat the number, 780-4909. And we have Howard Solomon calling in.
Oh, hi,
Howard. Stories. Howard, you there?
I am here. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So I'm listening to the radio, and I'm hearing Lois Reckitt talking about her multicolored fingernails. And I've known Lois for so long that her multicolored fingernails were actually, it's sort of like old movies. They were just in black and white when I first met her in 1989. Talking about community and the way in which Lois and a lot of other people were instrumental in helping create community for us in Maine was the Matlovich Society, which I also was involved in, and it was a really wonderful avenue for me to get involved in Maine, having moved here in 1987, been very, very focused on helping my partner at the time get through his passage of being unable to heal and dying from AIDS. And in 1989, I connected with Lois and a couple of other people. And we were involved in creating something called the Matlovich Society, which from 1989 all the way through the rest of the decade provided a safe space for people, not only in Portland, but from all over the state, once every 2 weeks, to come and be in a room with other queer people. And Lois, say some more about Matlovich, of how it started and how magical and healing and powerful that DIY space was that started with, what, 6 or 8 people, and within 2 months was attracting 150 or so from all over the state.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. The Matlevich Society was named after Leonard Matlevich, who had been the first person to really, get back in the military after he got thrown out for being gay. Mm-hmm. But
very public case back then,
public.
Nationally.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is a man named Ron McClinton, who was an anesthesiologist at what was then Mercy Hospital, who I met when I was having a hysterectomy because I was terrified of anesthesia. And he came and talked to me about, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so we became friends after that. And
it's a good bedside manner, by the way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. When he came back to Maine, or I came back to Maine, he had this idea that he was going to, it was really a early precursor of the community center now, because his dream was to have a community center. But he also had AIDS and was quite ill, but he was determined that he was going to make something happen, and so he started.
Hold on, Howard, you probably need to turn down your radio if you've got it on.
Anyway, so.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
High tech.
Yeah. Anyway, so Ron lived over on the West End, and part of the reason we got hitched up together is I was good at writing organizational bylaws, so he asked me to help organize this thing. But we ended up, the first meeting of the Matlevich Society was on Pine Street at the...
Our books?
Yeah. No, or, it was the...
It was a community center up above the store.
Yeah, the food co-op. The
food co-op,
yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so the first meeting... I read the section of my autobiographic book that is not yet done, talking about the first gay rights movement. Mm-hmm. So I read that at the meeting, and what the magic of Ron, every time, at that time we were meeting, he said, well, we'll meet every week. I said, Ron, you can't have an every week meeting. People are not going to come that often. So I said, well, every month. And I said, well, maybe, Ron. But we went from that to every 2 weeks. But basically what happened is we would recruit somebody to speak, and wherever we were. We didn't stay at the People's Building that long because there wasn't enough room for us, because we really did go up to like 75 people a meeting. We ended up at the Holiday Inn.
Yeah, on Spring Street, right?
On Spring Street, which was really wonderful because it was very public. I think the booking manager, whatever they call them, I think was gay. So it was very helpful. So we had a wide variety of programs. Some of my favorites we had 3 drag queens who came and did their transformation at the meeting.
Oh, wow.
So we watched these 3 men, just get entirely ready for drag. And I was just fascinated because it was just not my, not my growing up stuff, Yeah. And, we had, programs on homosexuality in classical Japan. Mm-hmm. We brought Barney Frank here to speak.
You brought Leslie Feinberg.
Leslie Feinberg, which is when I first started to understand about trans issues. Because I was, just blind to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So that speech from Leslie Feinberg was really transformational in my understanding.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you remember some of them in particular, Howard, Howard was the, after Ron died, Howard was kind enough to take the co-reins with me of Matlevich for a time.
Yeah, I remember still at the People's Building, I think was the first meeting I went to. In fact, I met Ron and you on Derby Day party at his house. He was a Southerner, so he always
That's
had a
right.
party
right.
on Derby Day, the beginning of May. And I was drawn into the group, And after Ron died, right, I Lois and I chaired the organization for a while. I remember still at the People's Building, Jerry Talbot coming to speak. He mm-hmm. must have been only the third or fourth speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Jerry. So there's also another piece of that history of who have been our allies
mm-hmm.
as we've been trying to organize, who from the non-queer communities has been there for us. And, of course, Jerry wrote the book on allyship from mm-hmm. the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that I used to love the most, Howard, was that in a world where gay men were in one place and lesbians were in
yeah.
another, that was not true of Matlovich.
Mm-hmm. That's
right. It was reflective, frankly, of this community, that
yeah.
We have never been that level of divided, in my view.
Yeah.
And the only difference you could tell is if we had a program that was particularly focused on women, there would be more women and slightly less men, and vice versa. But there was always men and women together at these meetings, and we really had a community camaraderie in a way that some cities did not have.
Yeah.
That's right, and that was one of the things that when I moved here from Boston, one of the things that I appreciated is that we did not have the luxury of being such a huge population that we could have an exclusive male or female groups, or if you wanted to work in an organization, you had to spend 3 or 4 or 5 years licking envelopes and being on a subcommittee in Maine. You came in, and if you had the magic marker and a poster board, you became the chair of the publicity committee.
Yeah.
That's
true.
The way it was.
Yeah. You're qualified.
And in terms of that DIY, that those conversations twice a month
mm-hmm.
went on for at least 9 years.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly the dates, but went on for 9 years. I remember we, as you said, we started at the People's Building. We went to the public library.
Yeah.
Real breakthrough.
Yeah, right.
Part of the drama of that, or the excitement, was that there was a slightly passive-aggressive security guard. We were there till 9 o'clock every night was it Thursday nights, Lois?
I think so. But yeah. We were only there till 9 o'clock. Period. No
period.
Flexibility.
Right. So at 8:45, whether we liked it or not,
they'd flicker the lights.
He would appear at the back door and flick the lights, and then that became part of the charm of. But then that also was why we moved. The library space was not large enough for mm-hmm. us. We had people driving 3 hours to be at that safe space from distant parts
yeah.
of Maine. Yeah, it was quite remarkable.
And
yeah.
with all due regard to the bar tour, it was the first safe place that didn't have liquor.
This is true,
yeah.
That was one of the mm-hmm. double-edged swords at the joys of the bars.
You're right, which is always an issue in our
mm-hmm.
community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Howard, I will say, so one, for those of you that don't know, Howard Solomon has written a really great chapter on the history of LGBTQ Portland from, I think your chapter covers maybe like the 90s forward, if I remember correctly.
Largely so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's of Queer Portland. And in the book I'm totally forgetting, it is some
Creating Portland, and it was
yes.
edited by Joe Conforti,
yes.
who was at USM at the time.
Yeah, and that is one of the few secondary sources on the history of queer Maine that we have. So it's a really, really great source. So as a historian, Howard, thank you so much. I loved that chapter. That was so helpful.
Well, thank you, and thank you for carrying on the work.
Yeah, and we also have, I will shout out, we do have the Matlovich Society papers. We do have, mm-hmm. Howard, we have your papers. In the collection here at USM. So if you are interested in those things, you can come and look at them. So you are listening to Rainbow Reflections in Celebrating Pride in Maine here at WMPG. I am Megan McGregor.
I'm Steve Bull.
Lois Reckitt.
And we have Howard Solomon on the line. We're talking about Pride in Maine.
Howard, any other thoughts about Pride? We were talking earlier, it's a kind of a time to take stock. It's how are you viewing the community and what's before us? And
well, that's what a juicy question.
I used to host a radio show.
I'm sort of looking for forward to the hour and 30 minute monologue you were going to
I did threaten that if people did not step forward.
That's why you're calling.
Yeah.
A public service.
Yeah, right.
You know, as for at least three of us on the panel so far, you know, as we're getting older, we're our vantage point gets larger and larger, and in a sense, for me at least, more and more humble. You know, as a recovering historian and queer man, Jew, artist, all of that, the older I get, the longer my vantage point is, the more I appreciate the reality that organizations are organisms. And like all organisms, we're born, we flourish, and then we transform in various sorts of ways. And so I've been having a lot of conversations recently with a particular dear friend of mine who is a gay activist from the early 70s, the very early 70s, who has been in some of the most radical take no prisoners kind of organizations in our history. And his sadness that, in a sense, pride has become so mainstreamed that he, as an old activist who was in and out of jails and beat up and all the rest of it, it ain't what it used to be. And of course, that's what all older people say. Well, I remember the days when we, you know, fill in the blank. And so,
well, one of my favorite moments in the movement was the day I got arrested at the White House for disorderly incommoding, which was a very interesting phrase that made me think I did something terribly I won't mention on the air in the street.
Yeah, let's not go into that.
But that's not what it was. Of course, we were protesting the fact that Ronald Reagan had never said the word AIDS.
Mm. Right.
Mm. Yes.
And there were 60-some of us, I think, that got arrested that day. 11 women and the rest were men. And when they took us to jail in D.C., they very cleverly put all the women in one cell and all the men in another. It's like they didn't get yet that was really probably not a way to keep us from fooling around. But anyway, not that there was any fooling around in the jail, but it's really an interesting day. And I have the honor of being the first woman, I believe, in the United States who was searched by police with those yellow Playtex rubber gloves on. You know, I don't really remember, there was a whole do that the police had those on because they didn't have, I don't know what, they couldn't find, so.
Yeah.
But it was because they thought they were going to catch AIDS from me.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you mind if I interrupt just one minute? This is Anella here. You're listening to WMPG Gorham Portland. This is the radio from the University of Southern Maine. We have to do that legal ID at 9 o'clock. Quick shout out to Rosita for giving up her radio slot. We are joined here by Steve and Megan, who are facilitating a little conversation, about a big conversation, about rainbow reflections, about pride, what it means to us, and the history of queer men.
And Howard Solomon's on the phone calling in and brought up the Matlevich Society, which he and Lois are very involved with back in the day. And we'll continue. So what are we looking at as a community coming forward? It wasn't too long ago that I was expressing concern to a number of people of my vintage about the fact that, you know, open fascists were in mass, I guess, marching through Monument Square, and it's not just happened in Maine, but in other places. Howard was on Outcast, the show we had on WMPG for 3.5 years, about the anti-Semitic horror of what happened in Pittsburgh. And so it's a matter of concern. I'm not a paranoid person, but I like to squarely face reality. And this country is so polarized now, and we are one of the targets. And transgender people especially are one of the targets. So without being really rainy and gloomy all day here, because I think we're a community with resilience and a lot of fight in us. So
it's something I think a lot of about here, you know, in a country that has so many guns and stuff, you know, we are a target.
Trust me, we just lost the vote on 72-hour waiting period this week. The House passed a ban on bump stocks, but I don't know what the Senate's going to do yet. So it's. I think that one of the things that has, well, Maine is different in some ways. I mean, people are astounded at what we manage to do sometimes. I think it's because the whole state, in a peculiar kind of way, is a small community. I mean, even though we're 8 hours, four and a half, five, 6 hours apart from the crown of Maine down to here, it's like there's a commonality. And there's also a pride in the fact that, our state motto, Dirigo is I lead. And people have that sort of in their head when they're organizing, that we can do things first, we can do things,
as Maine goes.
As Maine goes, I mean, there's some kind of weird karma of responsibility about that. And so we have, and it's easier to do things when there's not that many people you got to convince in order to start the thing blooming. Mm-hmm. And then we can just, spread out like one of those onions that, that's a very bad analogy. But anyway, particularly since I can't eat those onions anymore. But I think it's one of the things that happens here, I think, is if somebody gets an idea and they can find three people who think it's a great idea, then the next thing you know, it's 10 people who think it's a great idea. And I think as long as it really is a great idea, I think we've done pretty well at letting things bloom here and grow. And so I've been involved in starting a lot of different things in the state, and I think others can do that and are doing that in slightly different ways, not just in the queer community, but predominantly in the queer community. So I don't know. It's interesting to watch. And I have only one more year in the legislature, and then I'll have to sit around with Steve and watch more than I have been.
We'll do stuff.
Yeah, we'll do
stuff. Howard, you next.